ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hi, this is Mike Behe, Senior Fellow with Discovery Institute. In 1996, I kicked over the hornet's nest with my book, Darwin's Black Box, and Discovery Institute has been there for me ever since. They've been there for a lot of us, and you make that possible by your financial support for Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery Institute needs your help now more than ever. Please consider giving a donation today to support the Scholars of Intelligent Design. To give, go to discovery.org/CSC2021. That's discovery.org/CSC2021. Thanks very much.
On today's ID, the Future, distinguished chemist and inventor James Tour wraps up his conversation with Brian Miller, research coordinator for Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. In today's episode, Tour pulls from the mailbag to ask Miller questions from his show's audience. The primary focus, the mystery of life's origin.
We're going to start taking some questions because sure. You and I have had a great time together, but we've got to give these people a chance. In Origin of Life, people ask, what are the requirements for creating the first living cell? But can we properly answer that question, assuming that the first living cell occurred millions or even billions of years ago? Wouldn't a cell back then be much simpler than what we consider a simple cell today? What biochemical and informational requirements, if any, would be different in the Origin of Life inquiry for the first cell versus what we know of cells today? And before you answer that, let me just say, you said we need minimally 100 amino acids. I think you meant genes. We're going to need minimally 100.
You're correct.
We're going to need minimally 100 genes. And I had heard, you know, we're going to need minimally 256. We need some number of genes. We need something. But what would be the minimal cell? I think you covered a little bit of that, but answer it again.
Sure. Right. And when I referred to the 100 genes or 100 proteins, which they code for, that wasn't a cell. That was simply, this is a great question. That was simply the machinery needed to produce energy that would keep a cell away out of thermodynamic equilibrium, disequilibrium, or we call it homeostasis. So if you start with chemicals, what happens is as you move that system away from equilibrium, the further you're away from equilibrium, the more the concentrations are different from the environment, the more you've got proteins that are breaking apart, the more the thermodynamic forces are trying to pull you back to equilibrium. So what happens is you've got to provide energy at every stage of the origin of life to just simply fight against the thermodynamic forces pulling you back towards equilibrium. And that's why people like Nick Lane, people like Mary Hansma, they're trying to figure out, could nature produce this energy? And if you look at what could nature produce, either in a thermal vent or mica sheets, it's the tiniest, tiniest, tiniest fraction of what would be needed for any but the earliest stages of the origin of life. So what happens, as soon as you go out from equilibrium, you've got to have this molecular machinery that fights against the thermodynamic forces pulling you back. It's got to repair the proteins. It's got to repair the cell membrane. It's got to keep the concentration different from the outside. So 100 genes, 100 proteins, is an absolute, absolute bare minimum just to fight against the thermodynamics. Anything less than that, and any way you move away from equilibrium, you move right back. Now, if you're going to talk about self-replication, that's much, much harder. And I showed you from engineering, there's a theoretical limit to how simple a self-replicating system can work. You've got to have energy production. You've got to have information processing. You've got to have control gates. So you ask, well, how simple is a cell? You're going to get, if you look at work by people like Venter, you're not going to get much less than 300 amino acids at an absolute bare minimum. And that's with mycoplasma, which is a parasite. So it lives off a living organism.
You mean 300 proteins, 300 enzymes?
Yeah, 300 proteins.
You said 300 amino acids.
Sorry about that confusion. It's 300 genes, 300 proteins. And if you look at free living organisms, what happens is Free living organisms are in a more unstable environment, so they need more genes to deal with that environment. They have to build everything themselves. It's a difference between how you would pack to stay at the Hilton for the weekend versus the middle of the Gobi Desert. You need a lot more equipment if you're in the wild. So the simplest cells we know of have probably have over 1,000 genes and like a megabyte of information. So if you think about how simple can a cell get before it can no longer fight against thermodynamics, it can no longer self-replicate, you're dealing with hundreds of genes at the absolute minimum. Just to fight against thermodynamics is at least 100. So to go from here to here is an enormous barrier where you need probably at least like a megabyte of information, and you need very complex energy tools. So that's the situation.
Okay, good. Let me see here. In information technology, redundant systems fall under risk management, not necessary for operation, but to protect against data loss. Data risk management isn't necessary for operation of the bits, but engineers intentionally put that in for preservation of those bits. Example, RAID, one storage array, has two duplicated hard drives. Where one drive can crash, the system can still operate, and a replacement drive can be rebuilt using the good drive, all without loss. We have this same type of thing with DNA's double helix. What is the origin of the data risk management characteristics of DNA? It's a good question.
Oh, that's a wonderful question. I'm not a biologist, so I've learned enough biology to deal with what I deal with. So I would encourage you to have someone who's an expert in DNA to really flesh that out. So I'll just give a very bare bones description. Yes, you've got two strands of DNA, and what happens is there's error correction mechanisms when you replicate DNA, and they can tell if one of your nucleotides isn't matching the opposite strand. I think I may be off by this, but this I believe this is the case. So they can detect if there's some error that's taken place, and they can go back and replace the nucleotide with the right nucleotide. And what you do see is redundancies throughout biology. You see redundant genes, you might have redundant systems in the human body. A beautiful example is, I think it's called the laryngeal nerve. And what happens is there's this nerve that has this really long loop. And people said, oh, that shows poor design, because why would a good designer create a nerve with such a long loop? Well, when engineers looked at this, they said, this is exactly what we do. We create loops in our cords with slack for a lot of reasons, partly to piggyback other cords, partly to deal with motion. But in this nerve, what happens, you have two separate nerves going to your vocal cord from different directions. It's redundant. So if you cut one in an accident, the other still works, and vice versa. So the same way you have redundancies in human engineering, you see the same types of redundancies in biology, both in the cell and in more of the large-scale anatomy, for the very same purpose, to deal with problems.
Good. Why do origin of life discussions ignore the fact that any life which spontaneously emerges has to have some way of surviving before it can reproduce?
Yeah, that's a really insightful question, because if you look at attempts to figure out what did the first organism look like, you have to assume it ate something. Whether it's, you know, some sulfur compound, or you're feeding off of a thermal vent, or whatever. And the challenge is, cells are designed to feed off some food source, but the conditions necessary to produce a cell, even in one's wildest imagination, may be different from the conditions that provide that food. So if a cell spontaneously formed, it's not likely going to be in exactly the right place to eat whatever it's designed to eat. That's a huge problem. So people don't really think about that issue very much.
If we grant the miraculous, biochemical replicating hardware arises by chance, what of the software algorithm for the replacement policy and spell checker we find in cells in correcting errors? How does the cell know what an error in the genetic code actually is so it can correct it? Wouldn't that imply knowledge of what the biological code should be? Where does that special knowledge come from? Does DNA have error correction codes?
Yeah, and that's a great question, because again, what happens is DNA has all the information necessary to build your proteins and so forth. But again, it also has, I think, three error correction mechanisms. So there's three reasons it actually is so accurate. Part of it's a natural attraction, but part of it is these ways where biology can determine if things are out of place. So yes, there's error correction in DNA, which ensures the fidelity. And again, this question of purpose is pervasive in biology because every component in a cell is for a purpose that engineers can often predict. So a cell has to be entirely intact or it won't work at the most basic level. It'll break apart and turn into simple chemicals. So this issue of purpose, of irreducible complexity, of error correction are all interconnected in the design of life.
The response to Helen Hansma's theory that life could have begun between mica sheets in the ocean seems to indicate that the likelihood is infinitesimal, but does not rule out the possibility of occurring if given millions of years to occur.
Okay, so what happens is that gets into the nitty-gritties of a probability. So if you look at like Crookes fluctuation theorem, if you look at Evan Searle fluctuation theorem, Jeremy England's work, and you start to run the numbers, the probability of simple chemicals on the early Earth turning into the simplest possible cell are numbers like 1 divided by a 10 to the power of a billion. That's like a 1 over 1 with a billion zeros. So the lowest probability that anything can happen in our universe, our visible universe, would be like the number of atoms times the number, the age of our universe times the fastest interactions can take place. Based on that, the probability of anything happening that's less than 1 over 10 to the power of 150th is essentially impossible. That's a 1 with 150 zeros. So for life to go against the thermodynamic barriers is a 1 divided by a 1 with more like a billion zeros. And you could quibble, is it a million, 100 million? The point is it's not going to happen within our universe. And even if we had a virtually limitless number of universes, the probability is essentially zero unless it truly is an infinite number of universes.
Okay, how plausible is Roger Penrose's conformal cyclical cosmological theory? I don't even know what
okay,
that is.
This is a completely different topic, which deserves its own lesson. What's happening is another evidence of a creator is that the universe had a beginning, that time, space, matter, and energy all began. One way around this problem is that you have a universe that's cyclical, where it expands, it contracts, it bounces, it expands, it contracts forever. So there's no beginning, so you don't need a creator. And then you've got various authors that who've tried to get around this. Like Steinhardt is an example who's promoting this cyclical idea of a bounce. The problem is that you have to create a mechanism at each bounce which resets the entropy to a very low level. And those mechanisms are incredibly contrived for that purpose. And there's absolutely zero evidence they could exist. They do exist, and they would be completely unlike anything we've ever seen. So that proposal at this point is pure speculation that has no basis to believe it.
Given our lack of insight into where life comes from, how confident can we be that there is life anywhere else in the universe?
We can be very confident that there is not life in the universe if it was produced by a solely natural process, because the thermodynamic issues don't simply relate to Earth, but anywhere. And if you want to have a self-replicating system, carbon really is the only molecule that you can use. Silicon is too, the atoms are too, the molecules are too unstable with silicon. And carbon allows the complexity of a structure that no other molecule will allow without the sp3 hybridization. And if you want any self-replicating system, you're going to need lots and lots of information. So the same problems I talked about with our life, no matter what you imagine life to be, to have any system of complexity that can process energy, that contains information, you're going to need an intelligent agent to bring that about. So there might be life in other parts of the universe, but that life would have been created by God, just like we were. And C.S. Lewis postulated that possibility. But we just currently have no evidence for it at the moment.
Okay. NASA is collecting samples from an asteroid that some claim will inform us about the origin of life. Why do they say this? And is this claim true?
What happens is when you look at various asteroids or meteorite crashes, you can find certain precursors to biochemical building blocks. Like you might find some carbon-based materials, maybe something that could help produce an RNA or something. So that is what gives them hope. They think maybe these meteorites, asteroids, whatever, could have provided the chemicals needed for the origin of life. The problem is they're always, again, in an intractable mixture with lots of other stuff. So you don't really get around the problems we talked about because you still have to extract it. You've got to purify it. You've got to then have information to put all the pieces together. So it's not really that helpful for origin of life.
Okay, suppose NASA eventually sends astronauts to the moon, to the moon Titan. And when landing there, they encounter what looks like a computer and a processor, memory storage and software code. What would the astronauts reasonably conclude as to its origin? One of our fallen satellites, perhaps? Chinese or Russian astronauts beat NASA there? Or aliens beat us there? Wouldn't each of these assume an underlying intelligence? Or was it rocks and erosion that did it?
Yeah, and that's a great idea of the design inference, because you'll hear people say it's unscientific to conclude design in nature. But again, if you found a computer mechanism on a moon of Jupiter, my favorite example is the movie Contact. So in the movie Contact, there's a signal from space, and then Jodie Foster realizes that this signal has a series of prime numbers, which you're not going to get from any natural process. And there's the encoded instructions for a spaceship. Now, if you use the logic of scientific materialism and you don't believe in aliens, you'd say, well, it's unscientific to argue that you see design from information. It's much more scientific to argue that there were self-replicating quasars or self-replicating stars that were being selected for spaceship-emitting signals. It's sort of the same logic. So when you look at it, the simplest possible cell, you see information with instructions, and you see machinery, you see energy production, information processing, error correction. So in the same way you know that your artifact on the moon of Jupiter or the signal from space in contact is designed, you know that life is designed also.
Okay, some Christians with reservations about the science of evolution separate those from issues of teleology, which they believe belong to metaphysics. Do you agree that these are separable?
No, I don't. Because if you look at, let's say, and again, there's a lot of very, very sincere Christians that want to promote evolution in the church for very noble reasons. They want to remove conflict. Very nice people, really respect their hearts, and I appreciate what they're trying to do. The challenge, though, and this is what people don't realize, is that if you look at Darwin's personal writings, when he spoke publicly, he would use God talk, but privately he acknowledges that he was a materialist. He embraced this idea there was no creator, everything was through natural processes. And when he developed his evolutionary theory, he actually read William Paley, and he used the same arguments of Paley, who had the famous watch argument, the same design language, the same examples, but he replaced the creator, God, with natural selection. So natural selection became a demigod that removed the need to believe design in biology. And it's the exact same thing with the ancient Greeks. If you look at the people like the Epicureans, who were influenced by the atomists, by Democritus, you look at like Lucretius, and what they did was they said, we see design in life, but we don't believe the gods were involved in the world, so we'll promote an idea of natural selection to remove the need for design. And when Paul in Romans 1 was talking about people suppressing the truth, who were ignoring the evidence of God's power and creation, the group he was engaging were the Epicureans, who believed evolution replaced the need to believe in a creator for the appearance of design in life. So evolutionary biology, as it's taught in most universities and high schools, presupposes that everything is a product of blind, undirected processes. There's no design. It's not a secondary cause used by God. And that's why they assume things are going to be suboptimal. They'll assume things are poorly designed. That's why in the 80s, people believed that a large portion of the human genome was junk DNA. Like 97% they believed was junk DNA, because they assumed that had to be the case because it was naturally produced. And then when people realize it's not junk DNA, but you know, most of it we can tell is functional, a lot of evolutionary biologists said if ENCODE is right, if that much is functional, evolution is false. So again, at a very deep level in terms of how the science is done, it's anti-teleological. So the philosophy and the science are integrated at a very, very deep level. Also, as you look at systems biology, to make progress, they use the language of teleology. They assume purpose. So the philosophy of teleology and practical everyday research in biology are intertwined. They cannot be separated.
Okay. Are scientists aware of any natural process that gives rise to biological information?
Great question. And this really deserves its, this is a long topic, but the answer is no. And I have a whole series of articles. If you go to look up Brian Miller, Evolution News, look up my articles, I have a whole series on the information enigma dealing with that claim that natural processes can create information for free. I'll just quickly give an analogy. Imagine that you are sick and you come downstairs and your mother prepared you a bowl of alphabet soup, that soup with letters in it. And you notice in that soup that you have the word, the sentence, I hope you're feeling better, get a lot of rest, drink a lot of fluids, take care of yourself. Could you explain that message in the soup by the chemistry of the pasta or the physics of the boiling water? No, because whenever you have the arrangement of letters for a purpose, that always points to design. Now, you can create small amounts of information by chance. Like if you saw the word cat in your soup, you might assume that was by chance because that's not that improbable. But a very long sentence you're not going to see is there by chance. In the same way, if you look at the research on proteins, we have Doug Axe's research on proteins. And I continued that research by drawing upon the research of Dan Tofik. And based on his research, a direct mathematical analysis on his research, the probability of a random sequence forming a functional protein is 1/3 to L, where L is the length of the protein. So the largest protein that could be produced by chance would be less than 100 amino acids. Most of the essential proteins in life are much larger than that. So we know that there's no natural process that's going to produce large amounts of information that could help with the origin of life. In fact, you couldn't even produce a simple protein through a natural process because the probability of hitting that target is too small. And you have what are called no free lunch theorems, which show you that no strategy for finding a target on average is any better than a random search. So there is no natural process that will create information at a rate that's more efficient than a random search. And the amount of information you can create in a random search is very, very small. So that's just sort of a quick answer to that.
In the table comparing computers to cells, I didn't see a RAM chip in the cell column. Is it because we haven't discovered it in cells, or because RAM, which is random access memory hardware, isn't absolutely necessary for cells or computers to operate?
Right. And that's a great point, is you have to recognize that biology is different from human engineering. That's obvious. And it's different in the ways it's better, it's more efficient, it uses principles we probably don't even understand. So you're not going to see necessarily a perfect one-to-one correspondence in terms of the parts, but you will often see a beautiful correspondence in terms of the function. And I thought in that research paper, they actually did mention RAM. Like they talked about things like the messenger RNA, different things like that that may function like RAM. But you'd have to go through the paper to see the exact details. So don't expect there be an exact correspondence of parts, but expect the functions to correspond very closely in many, many cases. So that's just the key difference to make.
Okay, last question. Where does design fit in Genesis?
That's a great question. And obviously, different Christians will debate certain aspect of Genesis. Like the more traditional young earth creationists would argue that each day represents a design event. day one, God created sun, moon, and stars, and so forth. Someone who's, let's say, an old Earth creationist would argue that you see sudden points of creation, but maybe over longer periods of time. Other people might argue maybe it was more of a gradual process, but God infused the information more gradually as things are forming. So that gets more into the theology and the biblical interpretation, which is not my expertise. So that's probably good for another program. But let me just talk about the science. When you look at the fossil record, what you see is sudden appearances of radical new organisms without precursors. The classic example is the Cambrian explosion, where you see the first representatives of a lot of the major animal types appear suddenly without clear ancestors going back to the trunk of a tree. So, and there's many examples of like that in the fossil record. And the time period is on the order of like 1 to 10 million years when the largest transformations take place in nature. And if you look at papers like Dredd and Schmidt, you look at other analyses of how long it takes for new information to enter into the genome and spread through the population. For instance, like in fruit flies, it would take about 9 million years based on Dredd and Schmidt, their 2008 paper, I believe, for two specific coordinated mutations to appear and spread through the population. So in the time in the fossil record that you see the largest transformations, it's only enough time for two specific mutations to appear and spread through the population. In humans, the time it would take for two specific mutations just to appear would be over 100 million years. Well, the hypothetical lines going back to taking us from humans and chimpanzees to a common ancestor would be more like 7 million years. So the time scales indicate that there's massive infusions of information throughout the geological column where new life appears, and that's clearly where you have design.
Great, great. Well, Dr. Miller, Dr. Brian Miller, thank you. Thank you for this, and thank you for sharing. And you are a world's authority in the thermodynamics on the origin of life. And so I appreciate that we had the opportunity to get the very, very best. God bless you, my friend.
Thank you.
That was chemist and inventor extraordinaire James Tour speaking with engineer and physicist Brian Miller about one of the most extraordinary engineering feats in the history of the world, the origin of life. To see or share their entire conversation, jump over to YouTube and search for James Tour Science and Faith Podcast. You'll find the Brian Miller interview there, along with a lot of other excellent content. For ID the Future, this is Tom Gilson. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.